Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide, recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. Before we begin, I want to let you know that this episode contains discussion of suicide and self-harm. These topics can be deeply distressing, especially for those with lived experience or who may be struggling right now. Please take care of yourself as you listen. If this is not the right time for you, it's okay to pause, skip this episode, or come back to it later. Your well-being always comes first. If you or someone you love is struggling or in crisis, you are not alone, and help is available. In the United States, you can call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. If you're outside the U.S., local resources are available in many countries, and we encourage you to seek support in your area. This episode is shared with care, respect, and the intention to inform, not to sensationalize. Thank you for listening, and please be gentle with yourself. On a gray February morning in 1995, one of rock's most enigmatic voices stepped out of a London hotel room and into one of music's most enduring mysteries. The Manic Street Preachers lyricist, Richie Edwards, brilliant, fragile, and beloved, left behind a life heavy with pressure and pain. After his disappearance, his car was found near the Severn Bridge, a place weighted with symbolism and sorrow. But Richie himself was gone. No sightings, no answers. Just a trail that stops cold on the border between England and Wales. Nearly 30 years later, fans still return to that stretch of road, searching for meaning in the silence he left behind. Because Richie wasn't just a musician. He was a voice for anyone who ever felt invisible. And losing someone like that creates a void that never quite closes. Let's trace his final movements, the places that shaped him, and the mystery that refuses to fade. This is the last known trip of Richie Edwards, and how a person can disappear, but never be forgotten. To get to know Richie Edwards, we have to step back to the Britpop music scene of the 1990s. London was a buzzing city with possibility, contradiction, and restless energy that radiated through every club, every record shop, and every faded brick venue tucked down an alleyway. London was the beating heart of a music scene flux, a place where punk's bruised rebellion clashed with something lighter and louder that would soon be called Britpop. Now in those years, before the glitter of the mid-90s fully took hold, London felt like a crucible. Camden Town, in particular, was where you could feel music's pulse reverberate through the streets. Pubs like the Good Mixer became informal meeting places for musicians and fans alike, where a pint and a cigarette could segue into whispered conversations about riffs, lyrics, and rebellion. Now across the city, small clubs sprang up with names that now feel almost mythic. The Blow Up, founded in North London in 1993, was more than just a club night. It was a breeding ground. Bands and misfits queued up around the Laurel Tree, drawn by the energy of gritty punk infusion and a growing sense that something big was forming. Early regulars included future Britpop players and people who would define what British rock felt like in that decade. Meanwhile, the broader musical fabric of London in the early to mid-90s were messy, beautiful, chaotic, and endlessly creative. Britpop was emerging as a distinctly British reaction to the American grunge invasion. Music that celebrated local accents, local pubs, and a kind of everyday poetry in its lyrics, amplifying the zeitgeist of cool Britannia. But alongside that was the undercurrent of post-punk indie shoegaze and the remnants of the 80s alternative underground. The sound of hundreds of bands trying to be heard in basements and on borrowed PA systems. Now, the Manic Street Preachers didn't quite fit neatly into any one box. They were born of punk's ethos and intellectual fury. Their sound was raw, political, confrontational, and grew up alongside the first real rumblings of the Britpop explosion. While Blur, Oasis, Pulp, and others would soon dominate British charts with jangly guitars and cheeky swagger, the Manics carved out something darker, something sharper. They were alternative before alternative was cool, and unapologetically earnest in a world increasingly enamored with irony. And Ritchie was central to that. His lyrics, political, brutal, poetic, gave the band an edge that set them apart. On The Holy Bible, which was released in 1994, he and his bandmates peeled back the glam and the pose and revealed a world rowdy with despair and anger, haunted by cruelty and contradiction. From the storming rhythm sections to Ritchie's stark verses about self-harm and human frailty, the music was dark, visceral, and unforgettable. And yet, beneath the bravado and the mosh pits, there was something fragile in the air, something that mirrored Ritchie's own internal battles. London was exhilarating, but also a city of shadows. Its underground was bright with youth and creativity, yet overcrowded with bruised souls looking for meaning in the noise. Outside the clubs, outside the laughter and the LP sales, there were darker landmarks, places that carried a different kind of energy. Among them was the Severn Bridge, a sleek piece of steel and road linking England and Wales. But for many, it was something else. A suicide hotspot notorious to locals and emergency services alike. A somber crossroads perched above powerful currents and tidal churns that swallowed voices and stories whole. Now, unlike some bridges that attract folklore because of tragic leaps, the Severn has a practical feel. A motorway bridge, a daily route for commuters. Yet it also possesses stark, eerie beauty. Now, for those who know it well, the view from that crossing is almost cinematic. A long expanse of road lit by distant headlights across the gray swirl of water and sky. It's no stranger to sorrow. Many lives have been cut short there, and bodies rarely surface because of the river, the strength, and the undertow. Because of that reputation, when Ritchie's car was discovered near the bridge after he vanished, it sent chill after chill through those who knew its story. It was a reminder that even in a world dazzled by culture and noise, the quiet places, the bridges, the rivers, the endless stretches of motorway, hold stories of desperation and longing that we rarely confront until it's too late. So London in the 90s was a curious place for a man like Ritchie. A city alive with sound and possibility, yet also a mirror for his contradictions. Exhilarating one moment and overwhelming the next. It was a place where music and melancholy coexisted, where pub gigs and burning poetry carried the same breath as invisible battles no one knew quite how to fight. And somewhere along those tangled streets, his story became not just a missing person mystery, but a cultural wound, a version of the 90s that refuses to heal quietly. Richard James Edwards entered the world on December 22, 1967, in the quiet mining town of Blackwood, Caerphilly, Wales. A place of terraced houses, misty hills, and a tight-knit community that moved at its own steady rhythm. To his parents, Graham and Sherry Edwards, he was simply Ritchie. To his younger sister, Rachel, born 2 years later, he was a protector, a confidant, and a best friend. The Edwards family wasn't glamorous, but they were warm. His parents were both hairdressers, known in the neighborhood for being kind, funny, and steady. Their home was full of books, love, and the sounds of kids doing well in school. They spent weekends walking their dog Snoopy through the Welsh countryside. Small moments that Richie would later describe as some of the happiest of his life. Now, those early years formed the foundation of who he was. Gentle, sensitive, observant. A kid who read constantly, who saw the world a little differently, who felt things deeply. After high school, Richie left Blackwood for the University of Wales in Swansea, studying political history from 1986 to 1989. He was introverted, thoughtful, fascinated by philosophy, literature, and the dark corners of culture. But Swansea also brought him lifelong friendships, most importantly with Nicky Wire. Nicky was playing guitar in a loud, idealistic punk band, then known as Betty Blue, before they renamed themselves the Manic Street Preachers. Through long conversations, shared obsessions, and the same restless fire, Richie drifted into their orbit. At first, he was just helping out, driving the van, carrying amps, writing manifestos and letters. He became their roadie. But when the band's bassist quit, Nicky shifted to bass and Richie stepped in as rhythm guitarist, even though playing guitar wasn't really his passion. He once shrugged off the criticisms of his technique by asking, "Why is everyone hung up on an ugly piece of wood and metal and strings?" His real instrument was language, imagery, ideas, and the band recognized that immediately. By 1989, he was accepted as the Manic's fourth member and spokesperson, helping shape not only their lyrics, but their look, their ideology, and their defiant attitude. That same year, they released Suicide Alley, their first independent single, a gritty, self-made calling card. A year later came the EP New Art Riot, which caught the attention of the UK music press, partly because of the band's outspoken attacks on rock star complacency. Richie was the spark behind much of that. Their confidence earned them a management deal, and in early 1991, the Manics released Motown Junk, another blast of punk-infused ambition. But it was during this era, still early in their career, that the world got its first major glimpse of Richie's inner turmoil. After a gig at the Norwich Arts Center on May 15, 1991, NME journalist Steve Lamack questioned Richie's commitment to the band's ideals. In response, Richie calmly took a razor blade and carved "For Real" into his forearm. The wound required 18 stitches. The moment became infamous, both shocking and heartbreaking. And it captured something essential about who he was. Earnest, intense, and struggling. The publicity from the incident helped secure a deal with Sony Records. In 1992, the Manic Street Preachers released Generation Terrorists, an audacious double album where an eerie track was paired with a literary or political quote. Reviews were mixed, but the album sold more than 250,000 copies and established the Manics as one of Britain's most vital new bands. Through it all, fans gravitated to Richie, not because he tried to be a star, but because he spoke openly about the things so many people kept hidden. Depression, self-harm, anorexia, loneliness. He talked about these subjects honestly, sometimes with dark humor, sometimes with painful clarity. He once explained his cutting by saying, "When I cut myself, I feel so much better. All the little things that might have been annoying me suddenly seem so trivial because I'm concentrating on the pain. I'm not a person who can scream and shout, so this is my only outlet. It's all done very logically." It was raw. It was disturbing. But it was also the truth. And people felt less alone because he said it out loud. Now, on stage and in interviews, Richie was striking. Leopard print, eyeliner, and a kind of chaotic elegance. He was literary and articulate, yet quite charismatic. He wasn't the band's best musician, but creatively, he was essential. Writing large portions of their lyrics, especially on their 1994 masterpiece, The Holy Bible, an album drenched in despair, politics, self-destruction, and unfiltered honesty. Many consider it one of the darkest, most brilliant rock albums ever made, and Ritchie is said to have written about 80% of its lyrics. But his personal life was crumbling. The same year The Holy Bible was released, his depression deepened. He struggled with alcoholism and anorexia. He couldn't sleep. He was admitted to Whitchurch Hospital and later transferred to the Priory for treatment, missing some promotional work and live events. The band performed without him at Reading Festival and Tea in the Park. When he returned, they embarked on a European tour with Suede and Therapy in late 1994. It would be the last time the Manic Street Preachers and Ritchie Edwards ever toured together. His final live appearance came on December 21st, 1994, at the London Astoria. The show ended in chaos. The band smashing their equipment, lights breaking overhead, and Ritchie destroying his guitar during the final song, You Love Us. It felt symbolic, violent, cathartic, maybe even prophetic. Just weeks later, on January 3rd, 1995, he gave what would become his final interview. Speaking to the Japanese magazine Music Life, he seemed fragile, but reflective. He explained that he'd shaved his head out of boredom. And he talked tenderly about Snoopy, the family dog who had died 2 weeks before. A loss that hit him harder than many realized. When asked about his stay at Whitchurch Psychiatric Hospital, he said, "I don't feel much different. I just realized I've got more time because my lifestyle has become healthy. I've quit alcohol and everything. I can now use the whole day. I used to start drinking as soon as I woke up, so the day was shorter." It was the last public glimpse of Ritchie Edwards. A brilliant mind, a wounded soul, a young man caught between genius and suffering, standing on the edge of something none of us could see coming. In the 2 weeks leading up to his disappearance, Ritchie Edwards began quietly withdrawing money from his bank account, £200 a day, every day, until he'd taken out £2,800 in cash. But no one knows exactly why. Some believed he planned to use it during the Manic Street Preachers' upcoming U.S. promotional tour. Others wondered if it was meant for a desk he'd ordered from a shop in Cardiff. But whatever the reason, those steady withdrawals now feel like the first footsteps toward a moment no one saw coming. February 1st, 1995 was supposed to be routine, or at least predictable. Ritchie and James Dean Bradfield were scheduled to fly to America that morning to promote the Holy Bible. But Ritchie never boarded the plane. And from that point forward, a clear timeline dissolves into a fog of scattered sightings, painful questions, and a mystery that still remains unsolved. The night before the flight, January 31st, Ritchie and James checked into the Embassy Hotel in London. They took adjoining rooms on the fifth floor. Ritchie was in room 561. They made casual plans to go out later, explore the pubs and cafes along Queensway, get something to eat, and try to unwind before the long haul ahead. It should have been an ordinary bandmate evening. Sometime before dinner, Ritchie phoned his mother. He told her he didn't want to go to America. She later said nothing in his voice worried her. He didn't sound scared or distraught, just tired, uncertain. That would be the last time she ever spoke to her son. When James knocked on his door later that night for their outing, Ritchie answered, but told him he'd changed his mind. He wanted to stay in, have a quiet night to himself. So James left, wandering the neighborhood alone, unaware that something very different was unfolding behind the door of room 561. In the days after Ritchie vanished, his family learned he'd actually spent that evening with a woman. Her name has never been confirmed publicly, but it's noted as Vivian in several sources. Some described her as a fan who'd become a friend, others simply as a familiar face. Now, it's unclear when she arrived, or how long she stayed, or whether she left the hotel with him later that night. Her presence adds another unanswered question to a story already filled with them. The next morning, James waited in the hotel lobby, bags packed, expecting Richie to appear at any minute. Richie was always punctual, always reliable about travel. But minutes turned into an hour, and when he still hadn't shown up, James went upstairs. He knocked. No answer. He knocked again. Silence. Concerned, he asked hotel staff to open the door with a master key. Inside, the room was still. Richie was gone. There was no sign of a struggle, nothing overturned or broken. Just an eerie stillness and a bathtub filled with water. On the bed sat a carefully wrapped gift box addressed to Joe, Richie's on-and-off-again girlfriend he had recently split from. Inside were personal items he'd selected with intention. Videos, books, photographs, and a copy of Equus, a play about trauma, identity, and the fractures that can split a mind in two. The box was wrapped like a birthday present, decorated with collages and handwritten literary quotes, a Germanic-looking house, Bugs Bunny, snippets of text cut from magazines. On the front, he taped a small note that read simply, "I love you." No one knew whether this was a goodbye, a gesture of affection, or simply an intensely personal gift. It sat there waiting in his empty room, and Richie himself had vanished. 24 hours later, the band's manager, Martin Hall, filed a missing person report at Harrow Road Police Station. Friends and family combed through his address book, calling everyone they could find, but no one had seen him. His parents, Graham and Sherry, refused to believe their son had disappeared. They didn't think he would leave them like that. His father even placed a notice in the Daily Mail that read, "Please make contact, Richard." James boarded the plane to the United States alone, devastated, but under pressure from the label. Meanwhile, Nikki Wire stayed in the UK, calling hotels across Britain to see if Richie had checked in anywhere, but no one recognized his name. On February 15th, Cardiff Police issued a public statement, an appeal that played on television and printed across newspapers. It described Richie's disappearance, the car he was believed to be driving, and the last confirmed sighting of him leaving the Embassy Hotel at 7 a.m. The message was compassionate. If Richie heard the appeal, he would not be pressured to return. His family and bandmates only wanted to know he was safe. In the weeks that followed, a clearer picture emerged of what happened after he checked out of that hotel. That morning, he'd taken his wallet, car keys, passport, and a few capsules of his Prozac prescription. When investigators traced his movements, they discovered that he'd driven straight to his flat in Cardiff, where he'd left behind both his passport and his medication, and a receipt from the Severn Bridge toll booth. But after that, the trail becomes stranger. In the 2 weeks after he was officially reported missing, several people claimed to have seen him. A fan said she'd spoken with him at the Newport passport office, and later at a Newport bus station, never realizing he was missing. They talked about a mutual friend before going their separate ways. On February 7th, a taxi driver from Newport claimed he picked Richie up outside the King's Hotel. The man in the cab had a Cockney accent, asked if he could lie down in the back seat, and requested to be driven through the Welsh valleys, including Blackwood, Richie's hometown. When they reached the Blackwood bus station, the passenger reportedly said, "This is not the place," and told the driver to take him to Pontypool railway station instead. It was later noted that Pontypool had no public telephone, an odd detail in an already strange account. Then came the discovery that shapes the heart of this mystery. On February 14th, Richie's silver Vauxhall Cavalier was given a parking ticket at the Severn View service station near the Severn Bridge. 3 days later, the car was officially reported abandoned. Inside, police found the battery dead and evidence that someone had been living in it. There were food wrappers, personal items, even photographs Richie had taken of his family after Christmas. But the detail that struck his mother most deeply was the steering wheel lock. Someone locked the car before leaving it. Sherry later told reporters, "Why would you worry about someone stealing your car if you were chaotically thinking of ending your life?" It gave her hope, fragile, flickering hope, that Richie might still be alive. Searches were held along the river. Fans stood at the bridge scanning the water, hoping to see anything. His manager hired a private investigator, but nothing concrete ever surfaced. And after years of silence, grief, and unanswered questions, on November 24th, 2008, Richie Edwards was legally declared dead on or since February 1st, 1995. His parents waited as long as they could. For them, the decision was practical, not emotional. They needed to settle his estate, which had remained frozen for more than a decade. Richie left no will, no children, and no spouse. His assets, valued at around £375,000 after liabilities, passed to his parents. But they never believed it meant his story was over. In 2009, the Manic Street Preachers released Journal for Plague Lovers, an album built entirely around Richie's recovered lyrics, his last creative fingerprint on a world he had quietly slipped away from. And nearly 30 years later, the mystery remains. No confirmed sightings and no evidence of death. Just a car abandoned near a bridge, a trail of scattered moments, and a young man carrying burdens deeper than anyone fully realized. Richie Edwards walked out of a hotel room one winter morning and stepped into a legend. One woven from grief, love, speculation, and 1,000 unanswered questions. His disappearance continues to haunt fans, friends, family, and anyone who has ever wondered how someone so loved, so brilliant, and so deeply troubled could simply vanish. Richie's trail ends with an abandoned car at the edge of Severn Bridge, but his story doesn't. In the years since he disappeared, every clue, every sighting, every scrap of possibility has spiraled into a maze of theories. Some heartbreaking, some hopeful, and some that sit uneasily in the space between. So now, with the facts laid out and the timeline as clear as it can be, we step into the shadows of what might have happened next. Even though Richie was declared dead in 2008, the question of what truly happened to him on that cold February morning in 1995 refuses to settle. The mystery isn't quiet. It hangs like a shadow, one that refuses to let his story close. In the early days after his disappearance, police approaches to the case were, by most accounts, disjointed and painfully inadequate. Rather than treating Richie's absence as a serious missing persons case, some in law enforcement initially assumed he might be stage managing his own disappearance, an ego-driven rock star stunt. They even searched his parents' home in the middle of the night with flashlights and suspicion, convinced he might be hiding there. The investigation was split across three separate police forces, making coordination difficult. And officers didn't interview the last people who saw him until much later, and inexplicably, there were no helicopter or river searches in those first days, when time mattered the most. For years, there wasn't even a DNA sample on file, only collected 10 years after he vanished. And within 6 months, one officer casually told a music magazine that it was highly likely Richie was no longer with us. Now, for the Edwards family, still holding on to hope, those words were like a blow. In 2018, a book called Withdrawn Traces offered one of the only pieces of new tangible information in decades, a detail that fundamentally reshaped how we understood the timeline. The toll receipt from the Severn Bridge, previously taken to show Richie crossed in the afternoon of February 1st, was actually stamped in a 24-hour time, meaning he crossed at 2:55 a.m., deep in the early hours of the morning. That revelation throws wide open the gap between his disappearance from London and the bridge crossing, and with it, the scope of what could have happened in that long, dark, intervening time. From there, the theories diverge, each carrying a different kind of sadness. And one of the most talked about explanations is the theory of suicide. The Severn Bridge, where Ritchie's car was found, is a notorious suicide location. So that's where many people's thoughts go. Ritchie had openly battled depression, anorexia, and self-harm throughout his life. And those struggles were well documented in his lyrics and interviews. Yet even this theory lacks the closure people crave. No body was ever found, and without physical evidence, it remains just that, a theory. And complicating matters further is something Ritchie himself once said in a 1994 interview about suicide. In terms of the word, that does not enter my mind. I might be a weak person, but I can take pain. And for those who knew him, that quote doesn't definitely rule anything out. But it does show a man wrestling with his inner world in ways that were painfully complex. Then there's the escape theory. The idea that Ritchie, overwhelmed by fame, pressure, pain, or simply the noise of a life lived in public, chose to vanish deliberately, intending to start a completely new life. Almost immediately after he disappeared, reports emerged of sightings in places as distant as Goa in India and islands like Fuerteventura or Lanzarote. Each sighting, whether in a market, at a bus station, or caught casually in conversation, was passed on by fans with a mixture of hope and uncertainty. Now, none have ever been confirmed, and none have ever been verified by authorities. Some versions of this theory even have a romantic angle. Whispers that Ritchie met someone while in psychiatric care, someone who later moved abroad, and that he simply left with her. It's the sort of story that sounds like a myth or lore or an emotional wish. And yet, it persists because it offers possibilities when there has otherwise only ever been absence. Other strands of thought emerge when you consider Ritchie's interests and personality. He was deeply literary, fascinated by reclusive or enigmatic figures in history and art. Some speculate he may have had traits consistent with being neurodivergent, possibly undiagnosed Asperger's syndrome, and that in retreating from the world, he was seeking sanctuary from sensory and emotional overload rather than choosing death. This theory isn't about glamorizing disappearance. It's about acknowledging the depth of inner life he carried and how painfully isolating that can feel. Some have argued that a man pushed into a corner by his own thoughts might seek escape, not ending his life, but fleeing into the quiet. Then there are the more human angles, that he may have lived for a time after 1995 without ever being traced, living under another name, adopting another life, fading into the background of a world that once demanded so much from him. Or that he may have passed somewhere far from cameras and news crews, his story ending without dramatic closure. Now for his family, first his parents and now his sister Rachel, none of these theories are abstract. They're personal. Some theories offer hope, others bring heartbreak. Rachel, who has spent years raising awareness about the pain of having a loved one disappear, has described the ambiguity, the not knowing, as perhaps the cruelest aspect of all. To never have certainty, to swing between hope and despair, is its own kind of suffering. And so, nearly three decades later, the question lingers. Was Ritchie Edwards a man who met his end tragically, quietly, beneath the dark waters of a well-known bridge? Or did he walk away from everything he knew, carrying only the invisible weight of his own inner world? We may never know, but in the search for answers, there is a shared humanity. The ache of loss, the desire for closure, and the haunting sense that some stories will remain unfinished, echoing forever in the spaces between fact and belief. At this point in the episode, I usually talk about travel safety tips. But this time, I want to talk about mental health. This episode touches on themes of self-harm, depression, anorexia, suicide, topics that are deeply personal, often painful, and sometimes overwhelming. If any part of Richie's story feels familiar, or if it brings up feelings you weren't expecting, you're not weak, broken, or alone for reacting that way. Richie spoke openly about his pain at a time when very few people did. For many, that honesty felt like permission to admit they were struggling too. Pain does not make you disposable, and suffering does not mean you were meant to disappear. Self-harm is not attention-seeking. It's a coping mechanism. Often a desperate attempt to feel something when everything else feels numb, or to release pain that feels too big to carry internally. And suicidal thoughts don't mean someone truly wants to die. More often, it means someone wants the pain to stop. If you are hurting right now, you deserve help. Not judgment, not silence, and not shame. You don't have to explain your pain perfectly to be taken seriously. You don't have to have the right words. You don't have to wait until things get worse. If you're in the United States, you can call or text 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, anytime, day or night. You don't have to be in immediate danger to reach out. They're there to listen, not to rush you, not to force you into anything, just to help you stay grounded in the moment. If you're outside the U.S., you can find local crisis resources at findahelpline.com, which connects you to free, confidential support in most countries in the world. And if calling feels like too much, consider this. Texting, chatting online, or even sitting silently while someone stays with you is still reaching out. It still counts. If you're not in crisis, but you recognize these feelings in yourself or someone you love, check in. Ask the uncomfortable questions. Stay present. Sometimes the most powerful thing you can say is, I'm here. You don't have to go through this alone. Stories like Richie's remind us how invisible suffering can be, even in people who seem articulate, creative, successful, or admired. They remind us that silence can be deadly, but connection can be life-saving. If this episode is too heavy, it's okay to pause. It's okay to step away. Taking care of yourself is not quitting. It's choosing to stay. You matter. Your story is not over, and help is available, even when it doesn't feel like it. Richie Edwards' story doesn't end with answers. It ends with silence. A hotel room left behind, a car abandoned near a bridge, a trail that fractures instead of closes. Nearly three decades later, we're still standing in that quiet space, trying to understand how someone so visible, so loved, and so deeply troubled could simply disappear. Whether Richie died, escaped, or lived on in a way no one ever discovered, what remains undeniable is the impact he had on music, on fans, and on conversations about pain, honesty, and mental health. His words still circulate. His presence is still felt. And not knowing still hurts the people who love him most. If you are listening to this and you believe you may have seen Richie Edwards at any point after February 1st, 1995, or if you have information, no matter how small, no matter how much time has passed, please come forward. Even details that feel insignificant could matter. You can contact local law enforcement or submit information through appropriate missing person channels. Richie Edwards once gave a voice to people who felt invisible. And in telling his story, we're reminded of something important. A disappearance doesn't erase a life. And silence doesn't mean absence. If you or someone you love is struggling, please reach out. And if you know something, say something. And finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you liked the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod, and subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates, and even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/thelasttrippodcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.